Yeah, I guess I should have to start off with an apology because this is really impromptu. So what you are getting is what I know from memory. So it will be quite basic. Those people who are well familiar with RNA structure may not benefit so much. So I don't have a diagram of secondary structure of ribosomal RNA, but so I drew something largely just from fantasy. When you see these secondary structures sort of drawn out, we were complaining the other day that they look kind of strange. So a friend once told me that they remind him of airport terminals. So we have here the airport terminal model of RNA structure. What you notice, and of course, you know, representing the base paired and unpaired regions, what you notice of course, is that the structures are made up of very short segments of double helices. And in fact, in ribosomal RNA, most of the segments are well less than 15 bases. Typically, 5 to 10 is more usual. Everybody's agreeing. But of course, these short segments of double helices are connected by these other regions that are not in Watson-Crick base pairs, so-called loops. So you can have, you know, terminal loops that cap off a stem. You can have junctions where several helical elements come together. There's these sort of big wheels where as many as sometimes 5 helices. There's a case in the 16S rRNA where 5 different double helical elements intersect. So these structures almost begin to look somewhat dendritic, and it is in part really the organization of all of these short elements of the double helices that can give rise to complexity in the structure. So as I think you all know, the A-form double helices that are formed by RNA are of themselves quite regular structures. If you have all Watson-Crick base pairs, there's relatively little variability in the geometry and the dimensions of the helix. The helix is quite stiff, has a long persistence length. So these base paired segments here really are sort of, you can think of them in some ways as fairly stiff, short, uniform rods. So the interesting part then is how you organize these in 3 dimensions. And of course, you can imagine that that has to do with the geometry of the bases in these regions where you don't have regular Watson-Crick base pairing. So that's really what tertiary structure is about. Of course, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Oh, sorry. So again, fantasy here. But what you will often see is that in fact, and this, the importance of this will become clear in a second, is that the Watson-Crick pairing will be interrupted by other kinds of pairs, so-called wobble pairs between a U and a G, for example, or G and an A, this kind of thing. And people often will indicate these by circles instead of lines. So as I started to say then, it's really the orientation of these helices that gives rise to complexity and dimensionality in the structure and enables RNA to form quite interesting and diverse tertiary structures. That's, of course, in contrast to DNA in its physiological state. DNA is essentially a long and uniform double helix, and there's lots of enzymes in the cells whose role is to make sure that it remains a long and uniform double helix. But that's obviously not true for RNA. So there's a few things to consider here. First of all, what are the interactions between the bases that are at the junctions between these helices? Because those will help in part determine what the relative orientation of the helices are. And then the other thing to consider is what kinds of long-range contacts one can make between different elements to bring the whole thing together. So just to flip back to this little scheme here. It's maybe too long for me. One could have the possibility, say, of interactions between this loop and maybe sequences down here, or, you know, loops that are far apart, for example, in the structure. And that's, of course, going to cause the whole thing to collapse into something that's far more organized and compact. All right. So, and I think I've already mentioned, yes, that this comes from really these long-range interactions. So I'm going to try to give you a few illustrations, again, largely from memory, of these things. Actually, I think I'm going to first talk about loop conformations and the different kinds of helix geometries that can arise when you have non-Watson-Crick pairs. And then we talk maybe very briefly how this kind of variability in the conformation of the RNA, local variability, can permit long-range interactions, such as loop-loop, loop-helix, and helix-helix packet. But people have really begun to start, this is not my work, but other people in the field, Eric Westhoff is one person who's done a lot of this, have really gone through and started to break down sequences into motifs. So people are beginning to see recurring themes as more and more RNA structures are determined to high resolution. I should say it's not possible to easily predict three-dimensional structure right now, but certainly people are beginning to catalog motifs and beginning to understand, you know, what kinds of interactions play, you know, what types of roles. So it's improving, and the more structures that are determined, I think, the more. That's correct. So it would perhaps be a particular sequence. I'll show you an example of these four loop sequences, and they recur very, very frequently in ribosomal RNA, far more frequently than you would predict from random, you know, sequence. And they have a very unique geometry, and they tend to play roles either in forming a very stable cap for the end of the helix, or more interestingly, in being one of these loops that can interact with another helix. So you can see repeating sequences or classes of sequences, and those sequences have similar structures in all the contexts in which they have been seen and seem to promote similar kinds of interactions. So that's what people call a motif. Yes and no. You could predict that you would form the four base helix, but actually, in fact, for four nucleotides is in fact not a particularly favorable loop conformation for most sequences, because at this point in time, the local deviation from favorable torsion angles that are required to make the sharp turn, so you have to have some unfavorable torsion angles to make the turn in four nucleotides. So four is a little shorter than optimum. It turns out five is optimum. You can imagine that as you make it very short, you start to have local distortions, which cause penalties. If the loop gets very long, then you have entropic penalties. So there's an optimum size, and that's typically around five, maybe six. Four is a little short, but there are other interactions that compensate that make these particular tetra loops very favorable. Yeah. So some of the principles that help determine how the helices are oriented with respect to one another can, in fact, be easily illustrated by tRNA. So if I can have the first slide, is that on? Which I alluded to very, very quickly yesterday. Yeah. So thanks. As I pointed out yesterday, so tRNA is a great example. You have many elements here. You have loops. You have a four-way junction in the middle, so you can get a lot from tRNA. So this is of course the structure of yeast tRNA phi. And one of the first things that's very striking, as you notice, of course, is that these four helices are organized into two coaxial stacks. This helix is stacked over on this one, and these two are stacked up on one another to form. So these two helices form this straight sort of helical form at the top, and these two are forming the one that goes down the bottom. So this is really an L between two sets of longer helices or helical stacks. And there's two sort of consequences from this. One is that it turns out that the stacking of the aromatic bases is really maximized. In fact, in this structure, it's, I think there's 72 or even at least 72 out of the 76 bases that are present in yeast tRNA phi are stacked on another base. So this is a very strong driving force for the structure. You can see that maybe here from this cartoon from the three-dimensional structure. You can see the stacking of the bases, and that stacking is maintained as you cross the junction between this helix, the acceptor stem, and this helix, the T stem right here. Same thing down here. So the fact that the stacking of the bases is such an energetically favorable interaction seems to propel many RNA structures into these sort of columns of longer helices that are formed. And the helices may not be covalently contiguous, but nonetheless, they're sort of conformationally contiguous. And this kind of thing is, again, showing up in many structures. I can show you in the group 1 intron that, in fact, this is what's happening there. When you look at the ribosomal RNA structures, both the 30S and the 50S, I've been struck by the fact that you'll see these sort of long helical swaths going through the structure. Some of them are really long and sort of almost making kind of large struts, if you will, through the complex. And again, those helices, very rarely are they actually, you know, again, covalently contiguous. But so clearly, in considering the orientations of the helices at junctions like this, one thing is that the helices tend to be stacked up on one another. Now, figuring out which of the two helices should stack with which others, that's the hard part. I'm not sure there's simple rules for that yet. That's the tough part. So the other thing is the conformation of the loops. And I said that they can be unusual. That's true. And one of the nice examples of this is the anticodon loop of yeast tRNA phi, which is right here. And I don't know how easy it is for you to see, but this structure here is not, it's not floppy and it's not open. The bases are continuing to interact. In fact, there's continuous stacking of the bases here, first on the inside of the loop, so you get really right down to the end. And then these bases are even stacked up on each other down the outside of the backbone. So all of these bases are stacked. That corresponds to these guys right down here. And the backbone makes a very sharp turn at the bottom here, and then the bases turn around and start stacking up the other side. And I don't have a good diagram for this with me, but there's very unusual torsion angles about one phosphodiester bond here at the bottom that helps make this sharp turn. And then there are other hydrogen bonding interactions that cross the loop, both between I'm pretty sure it's this U here that's sticking in here, which should be that one. That's hydrogen bonding across, and then also to, I believe, to another sugar further up in the stem. Now I'm really talking from memory. There should be at least one other hydrogen bond to, I think, a phosphate group that's holding this thing together. So there are, this is an example then of one of these sequences in which the although we draw this sort of as a circle on these airport models, it's not a circle. It has a defined preferred conformation. Yes?
Can you replace the looping there by some other, other bases?
Mm-hmm.
Do you always have this kind of structure?
No. So some of these are, I mean, the stacking will probably be preserved to some extent because that's been seen in many, many different loop sequences. These structures have been determined. But these cuts, yes, but having the turn in a very localized place and having these cross-strand interactions that help rigidify the conformation of the loop, those are sequence-dependent. And one sequence motif that shows up here and is a sequence motif where you have a U followed by, this should be a, actually this isn't, well, many of them are of the class UNCG. This is not quite that, but it's close. But here we have a U, and then it's typically followed by a few other nucleotides. Often this one is a G, but it can be something else. And and this has been called this sort of U-turn motif, and it's a structural configuration that's shown up in a lot of places, including the hammerhead ribozyme and all kinds of other places you'd never guess.
Would this form in absence of magnesium?
The tertiary structure?
Yeah.
No. And there is, in fact, a magnesium ion that shows up in the crystal structure that's interacting with the slute. Yeah. So these base pairs are stable in the absence of magnesium, but these tRNA phi requires some magnesium to stabilize the three-dimensional structures. Other tRNAs can form their tertiary structure without divalence, although typically it's less stable and they require a lot of monovalence. But. Okay. Since we're talking about loops, I guess, actually, couldn't you just turn the slide off for me? I should have left spaces between all these slides. That would have been more intelligent of me. But I wasn't. Just turn the lamp off. That's all we need for now. So since we were talking about loop motifs, I just tried to schematize. Oh, you need to ignore my drawings. I was trying, and I can't draw these from memory in three dimensions. In fact, I was. I have a better version of this that I wrote out more neatly. Oh yeah, let's get rid of this one. This is the old one. I don't want that. This is my second try. I acknowledge my lack of artistic ability here. So these are some of these tetraloop motifs that you're asking about, and. So there's this variety, UN, where N can be anything, CG, and again, there's two sort of characteristics of these that maybe you saw from the previous. One is that the stacking of the bases in the loop is continuous, and in fact it's contiguous with the sort of canonical Watson-Crick base helix that's beneath it. There's hydrogen bonding interactions that span certainly the first set of nucleotides that close the loop that help stabilize the conformation. And for this particular sequence class, very often N, so C will typically be stacked on the G. This base is very often sort of flipped out into solution. It'll be sort of pointing directly sort of out and away from the loop. So that makes it easy to understand why the identity of that base doesn't really matter for this motif. It also means that that base is available to interact with anything else that might come along. And that principle can be also seen in another class of so-called tetraloop sequences, where you have a G followed by anything, followed by a purine, A or G, followed by an A. And again, the G and the A here pair with one another in a non-Watson-Crick interaction. It's a so-called sheared pair where the G and the A are kind of lying side by side. I can maybe show you that in a second. There's hydrogen bonds from this G across to the residue that's over here, and that's particularly true with the sequences G, A, A, A. So this G can contact this base. There's another, and there's a also a base sugar interaction, again, that crosses a loop that stabilizes this conformation. So all of the sequences of this class tend to be quite stable. In other words, if you were to make little hairpins with some stem and cap it off by four nucleotides, and then you were to ask what the free energy of forming that hairpin is, and people did this experimentally, if you have one of these G and RA capped sequences, the stability of the hairpin will be, I forget, but it's at least several kilocalories per mole, so I don't know, 4 or 5 kT, I guess, that's the term for this. More stable than if you had some other, random sequence. And again, people stumbled on this by through surveys of ribosomal RNA sequences, and what they found was that the frequency of having these four nucleotide loops was far greater than what was anticipated. And then when they looked at those four nucleotide loops, they found that they very frequently fell into one of these two sequence categories. So clearly it was a recurring motif that had some structural benefit. More recently, another little motif has shown up, and that is a so-called tri-loop, and I didn't draw this fully, but there's actually just three bases that form a loop, and it's capped off by typically a single hydrogen bond. And this is actually seen, again, in many places in the ribosomal RNA, and one place that it turned up was in a crystal structure of a little fragment of the RNA that was determined, that binds to the protein L11, and that structure was determined by crystallography both in David Draper and Ed Lattman's lab, and then simultaneously in Venki Ramakrishnan's lab. And what they found was is that this sequence, which people had sort of drawn as a little bulge because they didn't know what to do with it, turns out actually to make a little three-nucleotide loop, and that loop stacks up on the helix that it is next to. And now that motif has been discovered in many other places in the crystal structures of the ribosomal RNAs. So that's another one. Yes?
I can imagine if you just have three nucleotides, I mean, the probability of getting the random is quite high. And I can imagine that that it is possible that they would be higher than you would predict, you know, because of evolution for these sort of structures. I'm just wondering, is there reverse engineering going on that if you look at other regions of the sequence, you tend to see fewer of these? Like if you look at the non-loop regions, you get fewer of these than you would expect.
That's a good question. It, with this tri-loop, might be more difficult to ask the question, but with the tetra-loop sequences, you could easily ask the question because you could certainly compute what the frequency of various tetranucleotide sequences are. This is easy. And I that's a very good question. I honestly don't know if anybody's ever done that. Oh, yeah, and so the helix, sorry, I'm not explaining. So there's a helix on top here that's going up, and one strand of it is coming off over here. So it's like the strand of the RNA comes in from here, 5 prime, 3 prime, it goes off and does stuff. Then it comes around and makes this little loop, and then this strand kicks off in another direction. So this A here, so this is not a case where this strand here is contiguous on this side. Actually, I kind of drew an example of this in my first cartoon. From fantasy. It wasn't complete fantasy. There is a secondary structure that looks like this in the 23S RNA. And actually, this little bump here is the little thing that becomes a tri-loop. And what it does is it actually makes that little, there's just one hydrogen bond here, one base pair, and that actually rotates, swings around, and stacks on top of this helix that's right here. And these two helices are sort of quasi-aligned with one another, although it's not a perfect stack. Yeah. And actually, this loop contacts that loop. Right. So, yes, that's right. So from a lot of these kinds of structures, you know, they're drawn to display the primary sequence and the secondary structure, but they're not drawn to display the three-dimensional connections.
These kind of things have to be incorporated into the interim growth of the increased program.
Some of them have been, but not all. So the tetra loop sequences have now been more or less, I think, incorporated. Everybody may know. I don't know. These are repeated. They have been. Yes, that was my understanding. And many of the other kinds of unusual base pair interactions that can occur, not only, say, UG wobbles, but also GA pairs and these kinds of things are beginning to be incorporated. Although what's... Yes, that's right. They also do now include terms for coaxial stacking between helices because there is experimental data to measure that. And it's usually worth 1 or 2 kcals per mole, typically. That's what the energies are, which is not that much less than stacking within a contiguous helix. So certainly these kinds of things are improving. There's other kinds of interactions that are not yet very well incorporated. And I don't think, for example, this tri-loop thing. That's very new, about a year old, and I'm not sure that's in there yet. So you're asking me, do non-loops involve? Wait, I just didn't hear. Are there known loops that involve magnesium ions? Am I understanding you?
Right.
Okay. One example is the anticodon loop of yeast tRNA phi. I'm just trying to think of other examples. Probably they are known, and I'm not knowing them off the top of my head. The gnRNA tetraloops aren't necessarily associated with having a divalent ion sitting there. Yes. 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 It's a different pairing, yes. I know exactly. Yes. So what Hervé is mentioning is, did Nacho say much about this in his talk? No? Okay. No. Okay, so it is this actually illustrates another very useful principle that he's talking about an alternative structure that's present in one, if you can turn the slide projector on, actually you can leave it on and off, I mean you can leave a fan on, let me turn it off. Yeah, great. So it's this stem right here. And in the tertiary structure of the ribozyme, or the domain, there's just three Watson-Crick pairs and some UG wobble pairs that characterize the stem, and there are five nucleotides in the loop. It turns out that that's not the lowest free energy base pairing interaction. You can actually just slide these sequences with respect to one another by just one base. That closes the loop up to be only four nucleotides, and it makes it one of these very stable tetra loop sequences. And you gain about two more Watson-Crick base pairs when you do that. So the stem now is now all Watson-Crick. So in terms of just base pairing interactions, that's a much lower free energy structure. But what Hervé is pointing out is that in the presence of magnesium, that is not the favored structure. And the reason for that is that in this configuration, the loop can make other tertiary contacts with residues that are over here. And it turns out that it can also make a long-range contact by base pairing. These nucleotides can base pair with this loop down here. So there have been now several examples where people observe that the lowest free energy base pairing interaction, in other words, the structures that maximize, say, Watson-Crick and other very favorable base pairs, turn out, in fact, not to be completely compatible with the native tertiary structure. And so there, obviously, the favorable tertiary contacts must somehow offset that. So I think it's not only the magnesium there, but it's more that the magnesium is helping to stabilize other hydrogen bonding contacts between the loops and other residues, and that's what's stabilizing the alternative conformation. Actually, since we are here, we can just keep going. So the ribozyme illustrates a couple things that we've already seen so far. First of all, this diagram actually is drawn to try to illustrate the long-range connections. So that's why in this cartoon, these helices have been sort of organized as you see them to illustrate the fact that in the tertiary structure, again, you have alignments of all of these base paired segments into long helical stacks. So you have one, two, three that are sort of packing together in a it's not fully parallel bundle, but these are parallel, and this one's a little bit offset. And then you have two more that are basically perpendicular to the stack. So when the three-dimensional structure of this domain was determined by Jennifer Doudna and her coworkers at to moderately high resolution, 2.8 angstroms, that was another example that another place where people started learning about some of these motifs. And so this is just the this is a ribbon diagram of the whole domain. I don't think we actually need this. But I really want us to keep going. There we go. And so this illustrated a few things. So this is this stem again that Hervé was just talking about. And I said that it contacts residues over here. And maybe you can see that. This green stretch here is actually the ribbon diagram that corresponds to this little bit of helix. So what's going on here is that these helices are more or less all stacked upon one another. So that's forming this column. And then there's a sharp turn at the top. And that turn corresponds to some residues that are, again, not in Watson-Crick base pairs. So it's easier to distort the geometry. And in fact, if you replace these sequences with Watson-Crick paired nucleotides, you can no longer get this kind of bent over configuration, actually. The molecule remains straight. So this flexibility here is opposed, in fact, by Watson-Crick pairs, and it's favored by some unusual base interactions that are present. And then you come down and you make another stack here, which is right here. And the interactions between these two sides of the structure are favored by a number of contacts. So some include hydrogen bond interactions between this sort of complicated twisted over structure that's right here in green and some residues over here. And what that turns out to involve, at least in part, is I don't know how easily you can see from this orientation, but this strand here in the back is kind of very twisted around. It makes like a very short turn. And the authors named it a corkscrew, needless to say. There's a bunch of, and it corresponds to this part of the sequence, which has a lot of adenosines in it and a few uridines. It turns out that this tight turn, this kind of corkscrew, appears to involve a few, I think there's at least two right there, but one for certain, one magnesium that's right in the middle, and I think there's another one nearby that's interacting with the phosphates that make this turn. So to me, this is a little bit, it's sort of vaguely reminiscent of these kind of P loops that you see in proteins, where the peptide bond takes a very kind of sharp turn and it's interacting with a phosphate. Here, it's kind of the reverse. We have the phosphates taking a sharp turn, and there's like a positively charged ion that's kind of sitting in the middle, holding that together. The consequences of this is that the adenosines are splayed out in a few directions to be able to make contacts with other nucleotides, both here in the front and things in the back. And the other consequences is that the ribose residues are sitting out on this surface, and they are in a position to make hydrogen bond interactions with ribose groups that are over here. And the authors termed this a so-called ribose zipper. So this is involving just purely hydrogen bond interactions involving the 2' OH groups on the sugars and not necessarily the bases. So quite frankly, I'm not sure how you would predict this easily. This one's tough. This doesn't fall into an easily defined motif, but it's important. If you mutate these residues, this structure is very destabilized, so it's important. Then the thing that is a motif, and it's much easier, is this loop helix interaction. So this loop happens to be one of these GAA class loops, and it has, again, makes a very defined geometry here. And what you can't see from the ribbon diagram is that the bases are, again, all stacked. All these A's are stacked on one another. And they kind of line up on one face here of this helix, directed outwards towards this helix that's over here in blue. So that means that the faces of the bases, or their edges, are sort of pointed out directly, you know, away from the loop and over here. So that means that they can interact, and they do interact. And they interact with this region of the helix. So before we go on any further, I have to kind of back up and say a little bit what I was going to say, which is about this helix geometry, because maybe what you can see already from this ribbon diagram is that the dimensions of this helix here should be looking strange to you. So this would be a ribbon diagram for a normal A-form helix, a regular geometry. And you can see that the geometry here is not regular. Right? It's not the canonical geometry. At least I hope you can see. All right, so the thing I was going to say, if you can just turn the lamp off on the slide. There's going to be a few things about helices. So I said that the A-form helices have a regular geometry, and that's true. And it turns out that there's several other, this is some freshman chemistry or something for you. So that's true. And it turns out that another property of A-form helices is that, as you probably know, there's two grooves. And these grooves arise from sort of, you know, ridges that are created by the sugars and the phosphates. You can almost imagine those to be the outside of the spiral staircase. And you have the rungs of the staircase that are twisting around. And because the outsides of the staircase are quite thick, you know, you have sort of an indentation where you're looking at the edges of the rungs, right? So the edges of the rungs are the edges of the bases, because the bases, of course, are stacked on one another like plates. And so the various groups that are present on the bases are facing outward into these grooves. And there's two. One of these sides is, so the sugars are here and here, so they're not actually positioned 180 degrees apart. So one side, they're a little closer together. That's the so-called minor groove. And they're a little further away on the other side. That's the so-called major groove. And it turns out that in DNA, which typically forms a so-called B-form helix in aqueous solution, this major groove is fairly large. It's big. In fact, it's big enough that an alpha helix from a protein can go right in there. And that's, in fact, how many proteins interact with DNA. In RNA, that major groove turns out to be very, very narrow and very deep. So it's kind of like a deep sort of crevice that's going back into the helix. Whereas this minor groove is very shallow and flat surface. So that arises because the center of the helix has been displaced. It's not like right in the center of the base pair, but it's pushed off a little bit to one side. So this part of the base is very much pushed out towards solvent, and this is sort of retracted in. So this has some consequences for making interesting structures with RNA and having proteins interact with RNA. It turns out that the hydrogen bonding groups that are present on the minor groove face vary quite a bit less with sequence than those on the major groove face. So what maybe you can envision, I just drew all the various hydrogen bond donors and acceptors up there on the top. That's what's going on up there, just for guanosine. And so maybe what you can try to imagine is, as you form the helix or any structure in the RNA, what you're really generating is a three-dimensional array of groups that can either donate a proton or accept a proton as part of a hydrogen bond. And it's these networks of hydrogen bonds that lend a great deal of specificity to the particular structures. It's both secondary and tertiary structures. So the problem is that in an A-form helix, the part of the hydrogen bond array that would vary most depending on the particular sequence is the part that's the least accessible. And it's the surface that that's the most regular, invariant, depending on, you know, no matter the sequence. That is the most solvent accessible. So So what happens? Well, it turns out in many structures that people have seen, both RNA and RNA protein complexes, is that the tertiary interactions nearly and protein contacts nearly always involve either terminal loops at the ends of helices or so-called internal loops, places where people will kind of draw it bulged out because there's no Watson-Crick pairs. And these so-called internal loops, which don't have bases, will be stacked, so really they're helices, but they're helices in which the geometry is unusual. And I'm just have illustrated a few different motifs that have shown up. One thing that's shown up is people can have very frequently GA pairs, and often they will appear in tandem, and the geometry of the GA pair that's often seen here, it's a so-called sheared GA pair, has a consequence of actually tucking in a little bit the dimensions of the helix, and it creates a local sort of kink in the helix backbone. If you put two of them together, you can have a situation in which you start off with a fairly regular helix geometry, sort of do a little local kinking, and then you restore sort of regular helix geometry. So this combination of tandem GA pairs is very stable, actually, it turns out, and it fits nicely into a double helix, but it just creates a little bit of local distortion or variability that can be recognized. And there's other examples. One interesting example is a motif that has shown up quite a bit, and it's in the, and this is part of what makes that unusual helix that was in blue for the in the tetrahyme and the ribozyme, that the authors called it a platform. And they called it that because on one strand there's a U, there's a couple two A's that are paired, and I don't know if this sequence is correct, so don't copy it down. I'm literally flying from memory here. But what I know is correct is that there's two A's in a row here, and the alignment of the bases is unusual. Instead of having all of the bases on one strand stacked on one another, which is typical, the one A is basically kind of pushed over and is stacking with base on the opposite strand. So the other name for this kind of motif has been called a cross-strand purine stack, because there's purines from opposite strands that are stacking on one another. And the consequence of this is that it really opens up the major groove of the helix and puts these two A's nearly side by side rather than on top of one another, and really kinks the geometry. This has many consequences. If you can turn on the slide for me again. Thanks. Apologize. That's what's going on here in this blue region. Although there's a CG pair, that's not important here. This is for something else. And we mutated those. There's one of these cross-strand purine stacks in here. It turns out there's another one up here. Some stuff going on in here. Another one up in here. So this motif repeated several times within this RNA, and the consequence is that this groove here is really unusually open, this major groove, unusually wide, and that provides enough room and enough sort of unusual characteristics to enable hydrogen bond contacts between these A's on the loop and the helix. So this is a motif that has now appeared in many RNAs. It's so-called GA tetraloop receptor motif. There's actually 11 bases in here on both strands that form this very particular sequence that interacts with GA tetraloops. So that's one motif that seems to be a real motif, and you know, when you can find those things, probably it means that they're interacting with one another. So the other kinds of ways that you can get let me just put through the rest of the slides and see if there's anything else I have here that's any use. Oh, this is a space-filling model, which I didn't show yesterday. And I claimed that the thing was packed, so you can see it is. Although it's not entirely packed, so there's a hole up here. There's really solvent, and this is really not packed. But this is the tetraloop packing with the receptor, and this is packed. And this is that unusual kind of loop here where the so-called ribozipper. So this makes one other point that I was going to mention, and that is that these Hervé was asking about metal ions, and certainly these unusual base pairs that are showing up and causing these distorted helices are less stable than Watson-Crick pairs. So other things must compensate. And there's two things. First of all, many of these non-Watson-Crick pairs involve solvent molecules. So water molecules are actually part of the hydrogen bonding network, and they're there enough that people can pick them up in the, the electron density of the crystals. And then the other thing is that metal ions certainly help stabilize these. And this is just one example. This is two Gs that are actually sitting next to one another. Again, one of these sort of unusual loop structures that has these cross-strand purine stacks. The metal ion can sort of interact with both the phosphates, and at least in the crystal, appears to be coordinating solvent molecules that are interacting with the nitrogens as well, nitrogens and oxygens of the bases. And here's a case where you see the metals just sort of running down the groove. The other sort of simple motif that I didn't really.
What kind of metal is this?
What kind of metal? These are magnesiums.
Magnesium.
Yes, that's correct. And the orange sphere is the metal, and the aqua are the aqua ligands. Yeah. This particular structure was, they were able to refine the density to, I want to say 1.5 angstrom resolution, something like that. So it's the electron density map is quite high quality, and they can get pretty good information about the metals and other than the solvent. At 3 angstrom map, you know, it's hard to tell where the solvent is. That's just impossible. But and there's some other RNAs that have been solved to a nearly 1 angstrom resolution, and again, you get beautiful definition of the solvent. And maybe the only last motif to add in here, which I'm not sure I have down here. I guess the only last thing to point out is that, so in addition to, so one can have helix, so loop helix interactions, which have been seen quite frequently. And there's several other motifs that I haven't gone through, Terry, but people have published reviews that can. So loop helix interactions. One can also have loop-loop interactions. East tRNA phi is an example of that, where the two loops are contacting one another. And this can involve both regular old Watson-Crick base pairs. It can involve so-called base triple interactions, where three bases are hydrogen bonded to each other simultaneously. And it can also involve, you know, other sort of unusual hydrogen bonding interactions. In some cases, people see loop-loop interactions, and this is true in the tetrahymen intron, where there's like really like a mini helix. In that case, four base pairs, so four bases from one loop and four bases from another are actually paired with one another. And you can imagine that's a very strong interaction, and that one is easy because the loops are complementary. It's, you know, it's simple. Yes, kissing loops. Right. So-called kissing loops. And then the one that is the most difficult to predict, at least at present, are helix-helix packing interactions. And they're clearly important because people are seeing the helices packed up against one another in all these structures. As I said, you get these sort of quasi-parallel bundles of helices, and they're lying next to each other. And there are, you know, hydrogen bonding and interactions, solvent-mediated interactions that are holding those helices together. But those appear to be less regular and are probably induced by preferred conformations of the bases, which will sort of set up a particular surface. And that surface that's induced by the conformations of the bases then, you know, enables the two interfaces to interact in a specific way. But it's not in a way that one could very easily, right, at least right now, sort of say, aha, you know, that sequence is going to do this. That's right. In some cases, yes. So The group 1 ribozyme is, again, an example of that. There's a couple. Yeah. It's a low-resolution structure, but at any rate. So here's an example. Right here in the middle here, there's two things that are holding this helix together with that one. One is that there's a short bit of triple helix that's keeping the strands that connect these two domains with one another sort of oriented in the right direction. But the other thing is that this helix here is, again, it's distorted. It's one of these cases where you have these unusual bases. And so that's presumably providing the surface that will enable some packing against the stuff in green. Here's another loop helix interaction. Again, this is one of these internal loops. In this intron, there's this loop sequence that's in green, which is contacting the helix in purple. The tetrahymen intron, that's not one of these motif loops. But in many other group 1 introns, it turns out that this is another one of these GA tetra loops that's interacting. So it's, you know, repeats again. These distorted helices are no doubt able to pack with one another more tightly, probably, and probably a little bit more specifically than just regular A form. So I'm sure that I still didn't solve all your problems. Maybe you. How close? You mean in the side by side or end on end?
Side by side.
In some cases, it's within van der Waals contact. In some other cases, it's van der Waals contact, but with a few solvent and magnesium ions at the interface.
How does the association work in terms of the minor groove, major groove, those type of things, and then side by side?
That's probably known, and I don't know. Yes, so I don't know whether it's more favorable to have it at the major and the minor groove. But if it's the major groove would have to be opened. Distorted. It may be known, but I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for your patience.
Thank you very much.